Audible Inc. presents Speak Memory, an autobiography revisited. Written by Vladimir Nabokov. Chapter 1. 1. The cradle rocks above an abyss, and common sense tells us that our existence is but a brief crack of light between two eternities of darkness. Although the two are identical twins, man, as a rule, views the prenatal abyss with more calm than the one he is heading for, at some 4,500 heartbeats an hour. I know, however, of a young chronophobiac who experienced something like panic when looking for the first time at homemade movies that had been taken a few weeks before his birth. He saw a world that was practically unchanged, the same house, the same people, and then realized that he did not exist there at all, and that nobody mourned his absence. He caught a glimpse of his mother waving from an upstairs window, and that unfamiliar gesture disturbed him as if it were some mysterious farewell. But what particularly frightened him was the sight of a brand new baby carriage standing there on the porch with the smug, encroaching air of a coffin. Even that was empty, as if, in the reverse course of events, his very bones had disintegrated. Such fancies are not foreign to young lives, or, to put it otherwise, first and last things often tend to have an adolescent note, unless possibly they are directed by some venerable and rigid religion. Nature expects a full-grown man to accept the two black voids, fore and aft, as stolidly as he accepts the extraordinary visions in between. Imagination, the supreme delight of the immortal and the immature, should be limited. In order to enjoy life, we should not enjoy it too much. I rebel against this state of affairs. I feel the urge to take my rebellion outside and picket nature. Over and over again, my mind has made colossal efforts to distinguish the faintest of personal glimmers in the impersonal darkness on both sides of my life. That this darkness is caused merely by the walls of time separating me and my bruised fists from the free world of timelessness is a belief I gladly share with the most gaudily painted savage. I have journeyed back in thought, with thought hopelessly tapering off as I went, to remote regions where I groped for some secret outlet, only to discover that the prison of time is spherical and without exits. Short of suicide, I have tried everything. I have doffed my identity in order to pass for a conventional spook and steal into realms that existed before I was conceived. I have mentally endured the degrading company of Victorian lady novelists and retired colonels who remembered having, in former lives, been slave messengers on a Roman road or sages under the willows of Lhasa. I have ransacked my oldest dreams for keys and clues, and let me say at once that I reject completely the vulgar, shabby, fundamentally medieval world of Freud, with its crankish quest for sexual symbols, something like searching for Baconian acrostics in Shakespeare's works, and its bitter little embryos spying from their natural nooks upon the love life of their parents. Initially, I was unaware that time, so boundless at first blush, was a prison. In probing my childhood, which is the next best to probing one's eternity, I see the awakening of consciousness as a series of spaced flashes, with the intervals between them gradually diminishing until bright blocks of perception are formed, affording memory a slippery hold. I had learned numbers and speech more or less simultaneously at a very early date, but the inner knowledge that I was I, and that my parents were my parents, seems to have been established only later, when it was directly associated with my discovering their age in relation to mine. Judging by the strong sunlight that, when I think of that revelation, immediately invades my memory with lobed sunflecks through overlapping patterns of greenery, the occasion may have been my mother's birthday, in late summer, in the country, and I had asked questions and had assessed the answers I received. All this is as it should be according to the theory of recapitulation. The beginning of reflexive consciousness in the brain of our remotest ancestor must surely have coincided with the dawning of the sense of time. Thus, when the newly disclosed, fresh and trim formula of my own age, 4, was confronted with the parental formulas, 33 and 27, something happened to me. I was given a tremendously invigorating shock, as if subjected to a second baptism, on more divine lines than the Greek Catholic ducking undergone 50 months earlier by a howling, half-drowned, half-victor, my mother, through the half-closed door behind which an old custom bade parents retreat, managed to correct the bungling arch-presbyter, Father Konstantin Vetvenitsky. I felt myself plunged abruptly into a radiant and mobile medium that was none other than the pure element of time. One shared it, just as excited bathers share shining seawater, with creatures that were not oneself, but that were joined to one by time's common flow. An environment quite different from the spatial world, which not only man but apes and butterflies can perceive. At that instant, I became acutely aware that the 27-year-old being, in soft white and pink, holding my left hand, was my mother, and that the 33-year-old being, in hard white and gold, holding my right hand, was my father. Between them, as they evenly progressed, I strutted and trotted and strutted again from sunfleck to sunfleck along the middle of a path which I easily identify today with an alley of ornamental oaklings in the park of our country estate, Vera, in the former province of St. Petersburg, Russia. Indeed, from my present ridge of remote, isolated, almost uninhabited time, I see my diminutive self as celebrating on that August day, 1903, the birth of sentient life. If my left-hand holder and my right-hand holder had both been present before in my vague infant world, they had been so under the mask of a tender incognito. But now my father's attire, the resplendent uniform of the horse guards, with that smooth golden swell of cuirass burning upon his chest and back, came out like the sun. And for several years afterward I remained keenly interested in the age of my parents, and kept myself informed about it, like a nervous passenger asking the time in order to check a new watch. My father, let it be noted, had served his term of military training long before I was born, so I suppose he had that day put on the trappings of his old regiment as a festive joke. To a joke, then, I owe my first gleam of complete consciousness, which again has recapitulatory implications, since the first creatures on Earth to become aware of time were also the first creatures to smile. 2. It was the primordial cave, and not what Freudian mystics might suppose, that lay behind the games I played when I was 4. A big cretonne-covered divan, white with black trefoils, in one of the drawing rooms at Vera rises in my mind like some massive product of a geological upheaval before the beginnings of history. History begins, with the promise of fair Greece, not far from one end of this divan, where a large potted hydrangea shrub, with pale blue blossoms and some greenish ones, half conceals, in a corner of the room, the pedestal of a marble bust of Diana. On the wall against which the divan stands, another phase of history is marked by a gray engraving in an ebony frame, one of those Napoleonic battle pictures in which the episodic and the allegoric are the real adversaries, and where one sees, all grouped together on the same plane of vision, a wounded drummer, a dead horse, trophies, one soldier about to bayonet another, and the invulnerable emperor posing with his generals amid the frozen fray. With the help of some grown-up person, who would use first both hands and then a powerful leg, the divan would be moved several inches away from the wall, so as to form a narrow passage, which I would be further helped to roof snugly with the divan's bolsters and close up at the ends with a couple of its cushions. I then had the fantastic pleasure of creeping through that pitch-dark tunnel, where I lingered a little to listen to the singing in my ears, that lonesome vibration so familiar to small boys in dusty hiding places, and then, in a burst of delicious panic, on rapidly thudding hands and knees, I would reach the tunnel's far end, push its cushion away, and be welcomed by a mesh of sunshine on the parquet under the canework of a Viennese chair and two gamesome flies settling by turns. A dreamier and more delicate sensation was provided by another cave game, when upon awakening in the early morning I made a tent of my bedclothes, and let my imagination play in a thousand dim ways with shadowy snow slides of linen and with the faint light that seemed to penetrate my penumbral covert from some immense distance, where I fancied that strange pale animals roamed in a landscape of lakes. The recollection of my crib, with its lateral nets of fluffy cotton cords, brings back, too, the pleasure of handling a certain beautiful, delightfully solid, garnet-dark crystal egg left over from some unremembered Easter. I used to chew the corner of the bedsheet until it was thoroughly soaked, and then wrap the egg in it tightly so as to admire and relick the warm, ruddy glitter of the snugly enveloped facets that came seeping through with a miraculous completeness of glow and color. But that was not yet the closest I got to feeding upon beauty. How small the cosmos! A kangaroo's pouch would hold it. How paltry and puny in comparison to human consciousness, to a single individual recollection and its expression in words. I may be inordinately fond of my earliest impressions, but then I have reason to be grateful to them. They led the way to a veritable Eden of visual and tactile sensations. One night, during a trip abroad, in the fall of 1903, I recall kneeling on my flattish pillow at the window of a sleeping car, probably on the long-extinct Mediterranean Trandelux, the one whose six cars had the lower part of their body painted in umber and the panels in cream, and seeing with an inexplicable pang a handful of fabulous lights that beckoned to me from a distant hillside and then slipped into a pocket of black velvet. Diamonds that I later gave away to my characters to alleviate the burden of my wealth. I had probably managed to undo and push up the tight-tooled blind at the head of my berth, and my heels were cold, but I still kept kneeling and peering. Nothing is sweeter or stranger than to ponder those first thrills. They belong to the harmonious world of a perfect childhood, and as such possess a naturally plastic form in one's memory, which can be set down with hardly any effort. It is only starting with the recollections of one's adolescence that mnemosyne begins to get choosy and crabbed. I would moreover submit that in regard to the power of hoarding up impressions, Russian children of my generation passed through a period of genius, as if destiny were loyally trying what it could for them by giving them more than their share, in view of the cataclysm that was to remove completely the world they had known. Genius disappeared when everything had been stored, just as it does with those other, more specialized, child prodigies. Pretty curly-headed youngsters waving batons or taming enormous pianos, who eventually turn into second-rate musicians with sad eyes and obscure ailments, and something vaguely misshapen about their unicoid hindquarters. But even so, the individual mystery remains to tantalize the memoirist. Neither in environment nor in heredity can I find the exact instrument that fashioned me, the anonymous roller that pressed upon my life a certain intricate watermark, whose unique design becomes visible when the lamp of art is made to shine through life's foolscap. 3. To fix correctly in terms of time some of my childhood recollections, I have to go by comets and eclipses, as historians do when they tackle the fragments of a saga. But in other cases, there is no dearth of data. I see myself, for instance, clambering over wet black rocks at the seaside, while Miss Norcott, a languid and melancholy governess, who thinks I am following her, strolls away along the curved beach with Sergei, my younger brother. I am wearing a toy bracelet. As I crawl over those rocks, I keep repeating in a kind of zestful, copious, and deeply gratifying incantation the English word childhood, which sounds mysterious and new, and becomes stranger and stranger as it gets mixed up in my small, overstocked, hectic mind with Robin Hood and Little Red Riding Hood and the brown hoods of old hunchbacked fairies. There are dimples in the rocks, full of tepid seawater, and my magic muttering accompanies certain spells I am weaving over the tiny sapphire pools. The place is, of course, Abazia, on the Adriatic. The thing around my wrist, looking like a fancy napkin ring, made of semi-translucent, pale green and pink, celluloidish stuff, is the fruit of a Christmas tree, which Onya, a pretty cousin, my coeval, gave me in St. Petersburg a few months before. I sentimentally treasured it until it developed dark streaks inside, which I decided, as in a dream, were my hair cuttings, which somehow had got into the shiny substance, together with my tears, during a dreadful visit to a hated hairdresser in nearby Fiume. On the same day, at a waterside café, my father happened to notice, just as we were being served, two Japanese officers at a table near us, and we immediately left, not without my hastily snatching a whole bombe of lemon sherbet, which I carried away, secreted in my aching mouth. The year was 1904. I was 5. Russia was fighting Japan. With hearty relish, the English illustrated weekly Miss Norcott subscribed to reproduced war pictures by Japanese artists that showed how the Russian locomotives, made singularly toy-like by the Japanese pictorial style, would drown if our army tried to lay rails across the treacherous ice of Lake Baikal. But let me see. I had an even earlier association with that war. One afternoon at the beginning of the same year, in our St. Petersburg house, I was led down from the nursery into my father's study to say how do you do to a friend of the family, General Kuropatkin. His thick-set, uniform-encased body creaking slightly, he spread out to amuse me a handful of matches on the divan where he was sitting, placed 10 of them end to end to make a horizontal line, and said, "This is the sea in calm weather." Then he tipped up each pair so as to turn the straight line into a zigzag, and that was a stormy sea. He scrambled the matches and was about to do, I hoped, a better trick when we were interrupted. His aide-de-camp was shown in and said something to him. With a Russian flustered grunt, Kuropatkin heavily rose from his seat, the loose matches jumping up on the divan as his weight left it. That day he had been ordered to assume supreme command of the Russian army in the Far East. This incident had a special sequel 15 years later, when at a certain point of my father's flight from Bolshevik-held St. Petersburg to southern Russia, he was accosted while crossing a bridge by an old man who looked like a gray-bearded peasant in his sheepskin coat. He asked my father for a light. The next moment, each recognized the other. I hope old Kuropatkin, in his rustic disguise, managed to evade Soviet imprisonment, but that is not the point. What pleases me is the evolution of the match theme. Those magic ones he had shown me had been trifled with and mislaid, and his armies had also vanished, and everything had fallen through, like my toy trains that in the winter of 1904 to 05 in Wiesbaden I tried to run over the frozen puddles in the grounds of the Hotel Oranien. The following of such thematic designs through one's life should be, I think, the true purpose of autobiography. 4. The close of Russia's disastrous campaign in the Far East was accompanied by furious internal disorders. Undaunted by them, my mother, with her three children, returned to St. Petersburg after almost a year of foreign resorts. This was in the beginning of 1905. State matters required the presence of my father in the capital. The Constitutionalist Democratic Party, of which he was one of the founders, was to win a majority of seats in the first parliament the following year. During one of his short stays with us in the country that summer, he ascertained, with patriotic dismay, that my brother and I could read and write English, but not Russian, except Kakao and Mama. It was decided that the village schoolmaster should come every afternoon to give us lessons and take us for walks. With a sharp and merry blast from the whistle that was part of my first sailor suit, my childhood calls me back into that distant past to have me shake hands again with my delightful teacher. Vasily Martinovich Zhernosikov had a fuzzy brown beard, a balding head, and china-blue eyes, one of which bore a fascinating excrescence on the upper lid. The first day he came, he brought a box full of tremendously appetizing blocks, with a different letter painted on each side. These cubes he would manipulate as if they were infinitely precious things, which for that matter they were, besides forming splendid tunnels for toy trains. He revered my father, who had recently rebuilt and modernized the village school. In old-fashioned token of free thought, he sported a flowing black tie, carelessly knotted in a bow-like arrangement. When addressing me, a small boy, he used the plural of the second person, not in the stiff way servants did, and not as my mother would do in moments of intense tenderness, when my temperature had gone up or I had lost a tiny train passenger, as if the singular were too thin to bear the load of her love, but with the polite plainness of one man speaking to another whom he does not know well enough to use thou. A fiery revolutionary, he would gesture vehemently on our country rambles, and speak of humanity and freedom, and the badness of warfare, and the sad, but interesting, I thought, necessity of blowing up tyrants, and sometimes he would produce the then-popular pacifist book, Doloi Oruzhe, a translation of Bertha von Suttner's Die Waffen Nieder, and treat me, a child of six, to tedious quotations. I tried to refute them. At that tender and bellicose age, I spoke up for bloodshed in angry defense of my world of toy pistols and Arthurian knights. Under Lenin's regime, when all non-communist radicals were ruthlessly persecuted, Zhernosikov was sent to a hard labor camp, but managed to escape abroad, and died in Narva in 1939. To him, in a way, I owe the ability to continue for another stretch along my private footpath, which runs parallel to the road of that troubled decade. When, in July 1906, the Tsar unconstitutionally dissolved the parliament, a number of its members, my father among them, held a rebellious session in Viborg and issued a manifesto that urged the people to resist the government. For this, more than a year and a half later, they were imprisoned. My father spent a restful, if somewhat lonesome, 3 months in solitary confinement, with his books, his collapsible bathtub, and his copy of J.P. Muller's Manual of Home Gymnastics. To the end of her days, my mother preserved the letters he managed to smuggle through to her, cheerful epistles written in pencil on toilet paper. These I have published in 1965 in the fourth issue of the Russian-language review, Vozdushnye Puti, edited by Roman Grinberg in New York. We were in the country when he regained his liberty, and it was the village schoolmaster who directed the festivities and arranged the bunting, some of it frankly red, to greet my father on his way home from the railway station, under archivolts of fir needles and crowns of bluebottles, my father's favorite flower. We children had gone down to the village, and it is when I recall that particular day that I see with the utmost clarity the sun-spangled river, the bridge, the dazzling tin of a can left by a fisherman on its wooden railing, the linden-treed hill with its rosy red church and marble mausoleum where my mother's dead reposed, the dusty road to the village, the strip of short pastel-green grass with bald patches of sandy soil between the road and the lilac bushes behind which wall-eyed, mossy log cabins stood in a rickety row, the stone building of the new schoolhouse near the wooden old one, and as we swiftly drove by, the little black dog with very white teeth that dashed out from among the cottages at a terrific pace, but in absolute silence, saving his voice for the brief outburst he would enjoy when his muted spurt would at last bring him close to the speeding carriage. 5. The old and the new, the liberal touch and the patriarchal one, fatal poverty and fatalistic wealth, got fantastically interwoven in that strange first decade of our century. Several times during a summer, it might happen that in the middle of luncheon, in the bright, many-windowed, walnut-paneled dining room on the first floor of our Vera Manor, Alexei, the butler, with an unhappy expression on his face, would bend over and inform my father in a low voice, especially low if we had company, that a group of villagers wanted to see the Barin outside. Briskly, my father would remove his napkin from his lap and ask my mother to excuse him. One of the windows at the west end of the dining room gave upon a portion of the drive near the main entrance. One could see the top of the honeysuckle bushes opposite the porch. From that direction, the courteous buzz of a peasant welcome would reach us as the invisible group greeted my invisible father. The ensuing parley, conducted in ordinary tones, would not be heard, as the windows underneath which it took place were closed to keep out the heat. It presumably had to do with a plea for his mediation in some local feud, or with some special subsidy, or with the permission to harvest some bit of our land or cut down a coveted clump of our trees. If, as usually happened, the request was at once granted, there would be again that buzz, and then, in token of gratitude, the good Barin would be put through the national ordeal of being rocked and tossed up and securely caught by a score or so of strong arms. In the dining room, my brother and I would be told to go on with our food. My mother, a tidbit between finger and thumb, would glance under the table to see if her nervous and gruff dachshund was there. "Un jour, ils vont le laisser tomber," would come from Mademoiselle Golay, a primly pessimistic old lady who had been my mother's governess and still dwelt with us, on awful terms with our own governesses. From my place at table, I would suddenly see through one of the west windows a marvelous case of levitation. There, for an instant, the figure of my father in his wind-rippled white summer suit would be displayed, gloriously sprawling in mid-air, his limbs in a curiously casual attitude, his handsome, imperturbable features turned to the sky. Thrice, to the mighty heave-ho of his invisible tossers, he would fly up in this fashion, and the second time he would go higher than the first. And then there he would be, on his last and loftiest flight, reclining, as if for good, against the cobalt blue of the summer noon, like one of those paradisiac personages who comfortably soar, with such a wealth of folds in their garments, on the vaulted ceiling of a church, while below, one by one, the wax tapers in mortal hands light up to make a swarm of minute flames in the mist of incense, and the priest chants of eternal repose, and funeral lilies conceal the face of whoever lies there among the swimming lights in the open coffin. Chapter 2. 1. As far back as I remember myself, with interest, with amusement, seldom with admiration or disgust, I have been subject to mild hallucinations. Some are oral, others are optical, and by none have I profited much. The fatidic accents that restrain Socrates or egged on Joanetta d'Arc have degenerated with me to the level of something one happens to hear between lifting and clapping down the receiver of a busy party-line telephone. Just before falling asleep, I often become aware of a kind of one-sided conversation going on in an adjacent section of my mind, quite independently from the actual trend of my thoughts. It is a neutral, detached, anonymous voice, which I catch saying words of no importance to me whatever, an English or a Russian sentence not even addressed to me, and so trivial that I hardly dare give samples, lest the flatness I wish to convey be marred by a molehill of sense. This silly phenomenon seems to be the auditory counterpart of certain pre-dormitory visions, which I also know well. What I mean is not the bright mental image, as for instance the face of a beloved parent long dead, conjured up by a wing stroke of the will. That is one of the bravest movements a human spirit can make. Nor am I alluding to the so-called musci volitantes, shadows cast upon the retinal rods by motes in the vitreous humor, which are seen as transparent threads drifting across the visual field. Perhaps nearer to the hypnagogic mirages I am thinking of is the colored spot, the stab of an afterimage, with which the lamp one has just turned off wounds the palpebral night. However, a shock of this sort is not really a necessary starting point for the slow, steady development of the visions that pass before my closed eyes. They come and go, without the drowsy observer's participation, but are essentially different from dream pictures, for he is still master of his senses. They are often grotesque. I am pestered by roguish profiles, by some coarse-featured and florid dwarf with a swelling nostril or ear. At times, however, my photisms take on a rather soothing flu quality, and then I see, projected as it were upon the inside of the eyelid, gray figures walking between beehives, or small black parrots gradually vanishing among mountain snows, or a mauve remoteness melting beyond moving masts. On top of all this, I present a fine case of colored hearing. Perhaps hearing is not quite accurate, since the color sensation seems to be produced by the very act of my orally forming a given letter while I imagine its outline. The long A of the English alphabet, and it is this alphabet I have in mind farther on, unless otherwise stated, has for me the tint of weathered wood, but a French A evokes polished ebony. This black group also includes hard G, vulcanized rubber, and R, a sooty rag being ripped. Oatmeal N, noodle limp L, and the ivory-backed hand mirror of O take care of the whites. I am puzzled by my French on, which I see as the brimming tension surface of alcohol in a small glass. Passing on to the blue group, there is steely X, thundercloud Z, and huckleberry K. Since a subtle interaction exists between sound and shape, I see Q as browner than K, while S is not the light blue of C, but a curious mixture of azure and mother-of-pearl. Adjacent tints do not merge, and diphthongs do not have special colors of their own, unless represented by a single character in some other language. Thus, the fluffy gray three-stemmed Russian letter that stands for SH, a letter as old as the rushes of the Nile, influences its English representation. I hasten to complete my list before I am interrupted. In the green group, there are alder leaf F, the unripe apple of P, and pistachio T. Dull green, combined somehow with violet, is the best I can do for W. The yellows comprise various E's and I's, creamy D, bright golden Y, and U, whose alphabetical value I can express only by brassy with an olive sheen. In the brown group, there are the rich rubbery tone of soft G, paler J, and the drab shoelace of H. Finally, among the reds, B has the tone called burnt sienna by painters. M is a fold of pink flannel. And today I have at last perfectly matched V with rose quartz in Mares and Paul's Dictionary of Color. The word for rainbow, a primary but decidedly muddy rainbow, is in my private language the hardly pronounceable Spigv. The first author to discuss Audition Colorée was, as far as I know, an albino physician in 1812 in Erlangen. The confessions of a synesthete must sound tedious and pretentious to those who are protected from such leakings and drafts by more solid walls than mine are. To my mother, though, this all seemed quite normal. The matter came up one day in my seventh year, when I was using a heap of old alphabet blocks to build a tower. I casually remarked to her that their colors were all wrong. We discovered then that some of her letters had the same tint as mine, and that, besides, she was optically affected by musical notes. These evoked no chromatisms in me whatsoever. Music, I regret to say, affects me merely as an arbitrary succession of more or less irritating sounds. Under certain emotional circumstances, I can stand the spasms of a rich violin, but the concert piano and all wind instruments bore me in small doses and flay me in larger ones. Despite the number of operas I was exposed to every winter, I must have attended Ruslan and Pikhovaya Dama at least a dozen times in the course of half as many years. My weak responsiveness to music was completely overrun by the visual torment of not being able to read over Pimen's shoulder, or of trying in vain to imagine the hawk moths in the dim bloom of Juliet's garden. My mother did everything to encourage the general sensitiveness I had to visual stimulation. How many were the aquarelles she painted for me? What a revelation it was when she showed me the lilac tree that grows out of mixed blue and red. Sometimes, in our St. Petersburg house, from a secret compartment in the wall of her dressing room, and my birth room, she would produce a mass of jewelry for my bedtime amusement. I was very small then, and those flashing tiaras and chokers and rings seemed to me hardly inferior in mystery and enchantment to the illumination in the city during imperial fetes, when, in the padded stillness of a frosty night, giant monograms, crowns, and other armorial designs made of colored electric bulbs, sapphire, emerald, ruby, glowed with a kind of charmed constraint above snow-lined cornices on house fronts along residential streets. 2. My numerous childhood illnesses brought my mother and me still closer together. As a little boy, I showed an abnormal aptitude for mathematics, which I completely lost in my singularly talentless youth. This gift played a horrible part in tussles with quinsy or scarlet fever when I felt enormous spheres and huge numbers swell relentlessly in my aching brain. A foolish tutor had explained logarithms to me much too early, and I had read, in a British publication, the Boy's Own Paper, I believe, about a certain Hindu calculator who in exactly 2 seconds could find the 17th root of, say, 352-947-11475-60-275-13230-18973420-55-866-171392. I am not sure I have got this right. Anyway, the root was 212. Such were the monsters that thrived on my delirium, and the only way to prevent them from crowding me out of myself was to kill them by extracting their hearts. But they were far too strong, and I would sit up and laboriously form garbled sentences as I tried to explain things to my mother. Beneath my delirium, she recognized sensations she had known herself, and her understanding would bring my expanding universe back to a Newtonian norm. The future specialist in such dull literary lore as autoplagiarism will like to collate a protagonist's experience in my novel The Gift with the original event. One day, after a long illness, as I lay in bed, still very weak, I found myself basking in an unusual euphoria of lightness and repose. I knew my mother had gone to buy me the daily present that made those convalescences so delightful. What it would be this time I could not guess, but through the crystal of my strangely translucent state, I vividly visualized her driving away down Morskaya Street toward Nevsky Avenue. I distinguished the light sleigh drawn by a chestnut courser. I heard his snoring breath, the rhythmic clacking of his scrotum, and the lumps of frozen earth and snow thudding against the front of the sleigh. Before my eyes, and before those of my mother, loomed the hind part of the coachman, in his heavily padded blue robe, and the leather-encased watch, 2:20, strapped to the back of his belt, from under which curved the pumpkin-like folds of his huge stuffed rump. I saw my mother's seal furs, and as the icy speed increased, the muff she raised to her face, that graceful winter-ride gesture of a St. Petersburg lady. 2 corners of the voluminous spread of bearskin that covered her up to the waist were attached by loops to the 2 side knobs of the low back of her seat. And beside her, holding on to these knobs, a footman in a cockaded hat stood on his narrow support above the rear extremities of the runners. Still watching the sleigh, I saw it stop at Troimann's, writing implements, bronze baubles, playing cards. Presently my mother came out of this shop, followed by the footman. He carried her purchase, which looked to me like a pencil. I was astonished that she did not carry so small an object herself, and this disagreeable question of dimensions caused a faint renewal, fortunately very brief, of the mind-dilation effect which I hoped had gone with the fever. As she was being tucked up again in the sleigh, I watched the vapor exhaled by all, horse included. I watched, too, the familiar pouting movement she made to distend the network of her close-fitting veil drawn too tight over her face, and as I write this, the touch of reticulated tenderness that my lips used to feel when I kissed her veiled cheek comes back to me, flies back to me, with a shout of joy out of the snow-blue, blue-windowed, the curtains are not yet drawn, past. A few minutes later, she entered my room. In her arms she held a big parcel. It had been, in my vision, greatly reduced in size, perhaps because I subliminally corrected what logic warned me might still be the dreaded remnants of delirium's dilating world. Now the object proved to be a giant polygonal Faber pencil, 4 feet long and correspondingly thick. It had been hanging as a showpiece in the shop's window, and she presumed I had coveted it, as I coveted all things that were not quite purchasable. The shopman had been obliged to ring up an agent, a Dr. Liebner, as if the transaction possessed indeed some pathological import. For an awful moment I wondered whether the point was made of real graphite. It was, and some years later I satisfied myself by drilling a hole in the side that the lead went right through the whole length. A perfect case of art for art's sake on the part of Faber and Dr. Liebner, since the pencil was far too big for use, and indeed was not meant to be used. "Oh, yes," she would say as I mentioned this or that unusual sensation. "Yes, I know all that." And with a somewhat eerie ingenuousness she would discuss such things as double sight, and little raps in the woodwork of tripod tables, and premonitions, and the feeling of the déjà vu. A streak of sectarianism ran through her direct ancestry. She went to church only at Lent and Easter. The schismatic mood revealed itself in her healthy distaste for the ritual of the Greek Catholic Church and for its priests. She found a deep appeal in the moral and poetical side of the Gospels, but felt no need in the support of any dogma. The appalling insecurity of an afterlife and its lack of privacy did not enter her thoughts. Her intense and pure religiousness took the form of her having equal faith in the existence of another world and in the impossibility of comprehending it in terms of earthly life. All one could do was to glimpse, amid the haze and the chimeras, something real ahead, just as persons endowed with an unusual persistence of diurnal cerebration are able to perceive in their deepest sleep, somewhere beyond the throes of an entangled and inept nightmare, the ordered reality of the waking hour. 3. To love with all one's soul, and leave the rest to fate, was the simple rule she heeded. "Vot zapomni, now remember," she would say in conspiratorial tones, as she drew my attention to this or that loved thing in Vera. A lark ascending the curds and whey sky of a dull spring day. Heat lightning taking pictures of a distant line of trees in the night. The palette of maple leaves on brown sand. A small bird's cuneate footprints on new snow. As if feeling that in a few years the tangible part of her world would perish, she cultivated an extraordinary consciousness of the various time marks distributed throughout our country place. She cherished her own past with the same retrospective fervor that I now do her image and my past. Thus, in a way, I inherited an exquisite simulacrum, the beauty of intangible property, unreal estate. And this proved a splendid training for the endurance of later losses. Her special tags and imprints became as dear and as sacred to me as they were to her. There was the room which in the past had been reserved for her mother's pet hobby, a chemical laboratory, There was the linden tree marking the spot by the side of the road that sloped up toward the village of Gryazno, accented on the Ultima, at the steepest bit where one preferred to take one's bike by the horns, Bika Zaroga, as my father, a dedicated cyclist, liked to say, and where he had proposed. And there was, in the so-called Old Park, the obsolete tennis court, now a region of moss, mole heaps, and mushrooms, which had been the scene of gay rallies in the 80s and 90s. Even her grim father would shed his coat and give the heaviest racket an appraisive shake, but which, by the time I was 10, nature had effaced with the thoroughness of a felt eraser wiping out a geometrical problem. By then, an excellent modern court had been built at the end of the new part of the park by skilled workmen imported from Poland for that purpose. The wire mesh of an ample enclosure separated it from the flowery meadow that framed its clay. After a damp night, the surface acquired a brownish gloss, and the white lines would be repainted with liquid chalk from a green pail by Dmitri, the smallest and oldest of our gardeners, a meek, black-booted, red-shirted dwarf, slowly retreating, all hunched up, as his paintbrush went down the line. A pea-tree hedge, the yellow acacia of northern Russia, with a midway opening corresponding to the court's screen door, ran parallel to the enclosure and to a path dubbed Tropinka Sphinxov, path of the Sphingids, because of the hawk moths visiting at dusk the fluffy lilacs along the border that faced the hedge and likewise broke in the middle. This path formed the bar of a great T, whose vertical was the alley of slender oaks, my mother's coevals, that traversed, as already said, the new park through its entire length. Looking down that avenue from the base of the T near the drive, one could make out quite distinctly the bright little gap 500 yards away, or 50 years away, from where I am now. Our current tutor, or my father, when he stayed with us in the country, invariably had my brother for partner in our temperamental family doubles. "Play!" my mother would cry in the old manner, as she put her little foot forward and bent her white-hatted head to ladle out an assiduous but feeble serve. I got easily cross with her, and she with the ball boys, two barefooted peasant lads, Dmitri's pug-nosed grandson, and the twin brother of pretty Polyenka, the head coachman's daughter. The northern summer became tropical around harvest time. Scarlet Sergei would stick his racket between his knees and laboriously wipe his glasses. I see my butterfly net propped against the enclosure, just in case. Wallace Myers's book on lawn tennis lies open on a bench, and after every exchange my father, a first-rate player with a cannonball service of the Frank Risley type and a beautiful lifting drive, pedantically inquires of my brother and me whether the follow-through, that state of grace, has descended upon us. And sometimes a prodigious cloudburst would cause us to huddle under a shelter at the corner of the court, while old Dmitri would be sent to fetch umbrellas and raincoats from the house. A quarter of an hour later he would reappear under a mountain of clothing and the vista of the long avenue, which, as he advanced, would regain its leopard spots with the sun blazing anew and his huge burden unneeded. She loved all games of skill and gambling. Under her expert hands, the thousand bits of a jigsaw puzzle gradually formed an English hunting scene. What had seemed to be the limb of a horse would turn out to belong to an elm, and the hitherto unplaceable piece would snugly fill up a gap in the mottled background, affording one the delicate thrill of an abstract and yet tactile satisfaction. At one time she was very fond of poker, which had reached St. Petersburg society via diplomatic circles, so that some of the combinations came with pretty French names, Brelan for three of a kind, Couleur for flush, and so on. The game in use was the regular draw poker, with occasionally the additional tingle of jackpots and an omnivicarious joker. In town, she often played poker at the houses of friends until 3 in the morning, a society recreation in the last years before World War I. And later, in exile, she used to imagine, with the same wonder and dismay with which she recalled old Dmitri, the chauffeur Pirogov, who still seemed to be waiting for her in the relentless frost of an unending night, although in his case, rum-laced tea in a hospitable kitchen must have gone a long way to assuage those vigils. One of her greatest pleasures in summer was the very Russian sport of hodit po gribi, looking for mushrooms. Fried in butter and thickened with sour cream, her delicious finds appeared regularly on the dinner table. Not that the gustatory moment mattered much. Her main delight was in the quest, and this quest had its rules. Thus, no agarics were taken. All she picked were species belonging to the edible section of the genus Boletus, tawny edulis, brown scabber, red orontiacus, and a few close allies, called tube mushrooms by some and coldly defined by mycologists as terrestrial, fleshy, putrescent, centrally stipitate fungi. Their compact pili, tight-fitting in infant plants, robust and appetizingly domed in ripe ones, have a smooth, not lamellate undersurface and a neat, strong stem. In classical simplicity of form, boletes differ considerably from the true mushroom, with its preposterous gills and effete stipple ring. It is, however, to the latter, to the lowly and ugly agarics, that nations with timorous taste buds limit their knowledge and appetite, so that to the Anglo-American lay mind, the aristocratic boletes are at best reformed toadstools. Rainy weather would bring out these beautiful plants in profusion under the firs, birches, and aspens in our park, especially in its older part, east of the carriage road that divided the park in two. Its shady recesses would then harbor that special boletic reek which makes a Russian's nostrils dilate, a dark, dank, satisfying blend of damp moss, rich earth, rotting leaves. But one had to poke and peer for a goodish while among the wet underwood before something really nice, such as a family of bonneted baby edulis or the marbled variety of scabber, could be discovered and carefully teased out of the soil. On overcast afternoons, all alone in the drizzle, my mother, carrying a basket, stained blue on the inside by somebody's whortleberries, would set out on a long collecting tour. Toward dinner time, she could be seen emerging from the nebulous depths of a park alley, her small figure cloaked and hooded in greenish-brown wool, on which countless droplets of moisture made a kind of mist all around her. As she came nearer from under the dripping trees and caught sight of me, her face would show an odd, cheerless expression, which might have spelled poor luck, but which I knew was the tense, jealously contained beatitude of the successful hunter. Just before reaching me, with an abrupt drooping movement of the arm and shoulder, and a poof of magnified exhaustion, she would let her basket sag in order to stress its weight, its fabulous fullness. Near a white garden bench, on a round garden table of iron, she would lay out her boletes in concentric circles to count and sort them. Old ones, with spongy, dingy flesh, would be eliminated, leaving the young and the crisp. For a moment, before they were bundled away by a servant to a place she knew nothing about, to a doom that did not interest her, she would stand there, admiring them, in a glow of quiet contentment. As often happened at the end of a rainy day, the sun might cast a lurid gleam just before setting, and there, on the damp round table, her mushrooms would lie, very colorful, some bearing traces of extraneous vegetation, a grass blade sticking to a viscid fawn cap, or moss still clothing the bulbous base of a dark stippled stem, and a tiny looper caterpillar would be there too, measuring, like a child's finger and thumb, the rim of the table, and every now and then stretching upward to grope in vain for the shrub from which it had been dislodged. 4. Not only were the kitchen and the servants' hall never visited by my mother, but they stood as far removed from her consciousness as if they were the corresponding quarters in a hotel. My father had no inclination either to run the house, but he did order the meals. With a little sigh, he would open a kind of album laid by the butler on the dinner table after dessert, and in his elegant flowing hand write down the menu for the following day. He had a peculiar habit of letting his pencil or fountain pen vibrate just above the paper while he pondered the next ripple of words. My mother nodded a vague consent to his suggestions, or made a wry face. Nominally, the housekeeping was in the hands of her former nurse, at that time a bleary, incredibly wrinkled old woman, born a slave around 1830, with a small face of a melancholy tortoise and big, shuffling feet. She wore a nunnish brown dress, and gave off a slight but unforgettable smell of coffee and decay. Her dreaded congratulation on your birthdays and name days was the surfage kiss on the shoulder. Age had developed in her a pathological stinginess, especially in regard to sugar and preserves, so that by degrees, and with the sanction of my parents, other domestic arrangements, kept secret from her, had quietly come into force. Without knowing it, the knowledge would have broken her heart. She remained dangling, as it were, from her own key-ring, while my mother did her best to allay with soothing words the suspicions that now and then flitted across the old woman's weakening mind. Sole mistress of her moldy and remote little kingdom, which she thought was the real one, we would have starved had it been so, she was followed by the mocking glances of lackeys and maids, as she steadily plodded through long corridors to store away half an apple, or a couple of broken petit beurre biscuits she had found on a plate. Meanwhile, with a permanent staff of about 50 servants and no questions asked, our city household and country place were the scenes of a fantastic merry-go-round of theft. In this, according to nosy old aunts, whom nobody heeded but who proved to be right after all, the chief cook, Nikolai Andreevich, and the head gardener, Yegor, both staid-looking, bespectacled men with the hoary temples of trusty retainers, were the two masterminds. When confronted with stupendous and incomprehensible bills, or a sudden extinction of garden strawberries and hothouse peaches, my father, a jurist and a statesman, felt professionally vexed at not being able to cope with the economics of his own home. But every time a complicated case of larceny came to light, some legal doubt or scruple prevented him from doing anything about it. When common sense required the firing of a rascally servant, the man's little son would as likely or not fall desperately ill, and the resolution to get the best doctors in town for him would cancel all other considerations. So, with one thing and another, my father preferred to leave the whole housekeeping situation in a state of precarious equilibrium, not devoid of a certain quiet humor, with my mother deriving considerable comfort from the hope that her old nurse's illusory world would not be shattered. My mother knew well how hurtful a broken illusion could be. The most trifling disappointment took on for her the dimensions of a major disaster. One Christmas Eve, in Vera, not long before her fourth baby was to be born, she happened to be laid up with a slight ailment, and made my brother and me, aged respectively 5 and 6, promise not to look into the Christmas stockings that we would find hanging from our bedposts on the following morning, but to bring them over to her room and investigate them there, so that she could watch and enjoy our pleasure. Upon awakening, I had a furtive conference with my brother, after which, with eager hands, each felt his delightfully crackling stocking stuffed with small presents. These we cautiously fished out, one by one, undid the ribbons, loosened the tissue paper, inspected everything by the weak light that came through a chink in the shutters, wrapped up the little things again, and crammed them back where they had been. I next recall our sitting on our mother's bed, holding those lumpy stockings, and doing our best to give the performance she had wanted to see. But we had so messed up the wrappings, so amateurish were our renderings of enthusiastic surprise, and I can see my brother casting his eyes upward and exclaiming, in imitation of our new French governess, "Ah, que c'est beau!" that, after observing us for a moment, our audience burst into tears. A decade passed. World War I started. A crowd of patriots and my uncle Ruka stoned the German embassy. Peterburg was sunk to Petrograd against all rules of nomenclatorial priority. Beethoven turned out to be Dutch. The newsreels showed photogenic explosions, the spasm of a cannon, Poincaré in his leathern leggings, bleak puddles, the poor little Tsarevich in Circassian uniform with dagger and cartridges, his tall sisters so dowdily dressed, long railway trains crammed with troops. My mother set up a private hospital for wounded soldiers. I remember her in the fashionable nurse's gray and white uniform she abhorred, denouncing with the same childish tears the impenetrable meekness of those crippled peasants and the ineffectiveness of part-time compassion. And still later, when in exile, reviewing the past, she would often accuse herself, unjustly as I see it now, of having been less affected by the misery of man than by the emotional load man dumps upon innocent nature, old trees, old horses, old dogs. Her particular fondness for brown dachshunds puzzled my critical aunts. In the family albums illustrating her young years, there was hardly a group that did not include one such animal, usually with some part of its flexible body blurred, and always with the strange paranoid eyes dachshunds have in snapshots. A couple of obese old-timers, Box the First and Lulu, still lolled in the sunshine on the porch when I was a child. Sometime in 1904, my father bought at a dog show in Munich a pup which grew into the bad-tempered but wonderfully handsome Trainee, as I named him because of his being as long and as brown as a sleeping car. One of the musical themes of my childhood is Trainee's hysterical tongue, on the trail of a hare he never got in the depths of our Vera Park, whence he would return at dusk, after my anxious mother had stood whistling for a long time in the Oak Avenue, with the old corpse of a mole in his jaws and burrs in his ears. Around 1915, his hind legs became paralyzed, and until he was chloroformed, he would dismally drag himself over long, glossy stretches of parquet floor, like a cul de jatte. Then somebody gave us another pup, Box the Second, whose grandparents had been Dr. Anton Chekhov's Quina and Brum. This final dachshund followed us into exile, and as late as 1930, in a suburb of Prague, where my widowed mother spent her last years on a small pension provided by the Czech government, he could still be seen going for reluctant walks with his mistress, waddling far behind in a huff, tremendously old and furious with his long Czech muzzle of wire, an emigre dog in a patched and ill-fitting coat.